This is number 0085, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed the Stuff File program, number 0085. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, actor Farley Granger passed away recently, and several years ago I had the chance to do an hour-long interview with him. We'll play a bit of that conversation, including when I asked him what medium he enjoyed working in best.
The theater, because it's more enjoyable. You feel like you've done something more than movies. You know, movies, you usually shoot at the beginning. You shoot whatever it is that has the most people in it. You know, it could be the middle of the movie or the finale. And then you go back and you just shoot all cockeyed and everything. And you get used to that, but it's not good. And to start at the beginning and go to a middle and go to an end is heaven.
Michelle Sfikianos is the author of Useful Information for Everyday Living. It's a guide to help young people when they finally move out on their own. How prepared was Michelle when she left the nest?
My mother did, you know, she taught me how to do laundry when I was a teenager. She taught me to cook basic things, you know, when I was a teenager. But there's also that I had a home economics class when I was in junior high. So kind of felt like I had a little bit of a baseline. But then, you know, when you move out on your own and reality hits you, maybe it wasn't enough of a baseline.
Stuart Nolman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
I'm Stuart Nolman, and coming up on Book Banter, Jane Levy's sobering look at the legendary Mickey Mantle with The Last Boy, plus a selection of MVP titles about the Bronx Bombers. So that's Mantle, Mickey Mantle, number 7, center field, batting next on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0085, is Stephen Paul Leyva, who is the author of two very good books, Blood is Pretty, and also Hollywood is an All-Volunteer Army. You can find both of his books online, and you can check out his blog, and you'll find links to both his blog and his books by going to thestufffile.com. Thank you very much, Steve, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, we start off with a story from Reading, Pennsylvania. A Pennsylvania trucker may have saved his own life with an unintentional and very elaborate Heimlich maneuver. Now, police say 55-year-old Richard Paler of Fairless Hills, Bucks County, was eating an apple as he drove on a busy highway in Reading when he began choking. Authorities say Paler then lost consciousness and crashed through a concrete median. Investigators believe the apple was dislodged when Paler smacked his chest against the steering wheel. Police recovered the chunk of apple from the dashboard. Investigators spoke with doctors who backed up their conclusion that the accident dislodged the offending fruit. Gee, you know they always say an apple a day keeps the doctor away? Well, clearly that's a lie. Anyway, moving right along, the problem with dating a married woman is you never know when her husband may bust through your hotel room door with a chainsaw. In Spring Hill, Florida, 49-year-old Timothy Ray Brooks found his estranged wife in a hotel room with another man and was arrested after he knocked out the hotel room window with a chainsaw and punched the man in the face. Now, the hotel clerk told deputies that Brooks came to the hotel at around 3 a.m. carrying the chainsaw and looking for his wife. When the clerk refused to give him any information about guests, Brooks walked outside and allegedly smashed the passenger window of the clerk's car. Then he went looking for his wife until he found her. Now, the victim told deputies that he went on a date with Brooks's estranged wife, and after the date, they got a hotel room. Brooks punched the man 3 times in his face and head, then left when the guy called police. Brooks was arrested on charges of armed burglary, battery, and 3 counts of criminal mischief. Okay, I know there are a series of movies with chainsaw in the title, but seriously, when going out in a rage to look for someone, who thinks of a chainsaw as their first weapon of choice?
I mean, really?
Anyway, moving right along, here's a question for you. Do you think you're being a bad parent for setting strict limits for your kids? Well, here's what happens when you don't. In Fort Myers, Florida, 17-year-old high school senior Rachel Ann Hachero was arrested for allegedly pistol-whipping her mother and forcing her to buy the teen a car at gunpoint. Hachero has had a privileged life and hoped to attend an Ivy League school. She's a student at the exclusive Canterbury School in Fort Myers, but now faces charges of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon without intent to kill, unlawful possession of a firearm by a person younger than 18, and battery. The events leading up to her arrest began when Hachero called her mother and asked her to co-sign for a car, according to a sheriff's office report. Her mother refused, so Rachel allegedly threatened to kill her. Around 7 p.m. the same day, Rachel returned to her home wielding a 9mm handgun. That's when she allegedly pistol-whipped her mother and pointed the gun at mom's head, demanding she accompany her to the dealership. With the gun inside Rachel's purse, the mother signed for the car, a 2004 black Nissan 305Z, and Rachel left with her new purchase. Although she called police, Rachel's mother declined to prosecute her daughter, citing her status as an honor student and her acceptance into several Ivy League schools. Deputies still arrested the teen, and they transported her to the Lee County Juvenile Assessment Center. Spare the rod. Spoil the child. So much for those good grades. So much for that car. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first interview here on the Stuff File program, in Boston, 22-year-old Karen Morla Ramos was arrested at Logan International Airport upon arriving on a JetBlue plane from the Dominican Republic. State police said in a statement that she was caught with more than a kilogram of cocaine in a diaper she was wearing. Her attorney, Rochelle Burgos, said she is an innocent victim of the drug trade. Not much else here to see. Yeah. Just weird to think of an adult in a diaper smuggling crack in her crack. Yeah. Normal. An everyday occurrence at Logan International Airport. Normal. Let's get to our first segment, shall we? Actor Farley Granger, who was discovered by a talent scout in a local theater in the early 1940s and thrust into stardom thanks to directors such as Alfred Hitchcock, died at his Manhattan home Sunday, March 27th, at the age of 85, reportedly of natural causes. Granger, who considered himself an inexperienced actor at the time, made his film debut in The North Star in 1943. After serving in the Army, he took on the role of an intellectual murderer opposite Jimmy Stewart in Hitchcock's Rope in 1948. The 80-minute movie was well known because it took place in real time in what appeared to be one long take. Hitchcock also used Granger in what's probably his best role in Strangers on a Train opposite Robert Walker in 1951. Back in 2007, I had the chance to talk to Farley Granger. This was at a time when he was releasing his memoir, Include Me Out. It was an hour-long conversation that I had with him and his life partner, Robert Calhoun, the former executive producer of As the World Turns, the man who wrote the book with him, and the man whom he shared his life with for 45 years. Here now is just a small portion of that hour-long conversation.
You were actually underage when you first went to Hollywood, were you not?
Yeah, I was 17 when I was hired to do the North Star for Sam Goldwyn.
A couple of the classic films you did were with Hitchcock, Rope and Strangers on a Train.
Yeah.
Rope was absolutely brilliant, I gotta tell you. I was actually a film student, and we studied that film.
Oh, really?
Yes, we did. A great. What was it like working with Alfred Hitchcock?
Well, it was fine the first time, you know, with Rope, but it was just a very difficult film to make, and we had a lot of trouble on it. We had to redo scenes because it didn't work. It was, you know, all planned to be kind of all in one shot, and he planned it that way, but the film only goes for 10 minutes, so you can only do it then, and then you've got to be in a position, you know, so that when the next 10 minutes come, you're there and you go on. But with Rope, with Strangers on a Train, which was one of my most enjoyable movies. He was terrific. He knew it was good. He knew it was going to be a hit. And he was just very jolly and happy about it and everything. And I saw a lot of them. I was invited to the house there many times for dinner and drinks, of course.
Now, the memoir talks candidly about your work professionally, your public and private lives, and the fact that you were bisexual.
Yeah.
Was it difficult wanting to discuss that in print?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that was when I was really quite young, and I don't know, I did very well. I have no problems or no regrets.
Now, was there any difficulty, especially in the days of the studio system, being bisexual?
The thing was, I went in the Navy, and I came out, and I visited Lewis Milestone, who I had worked in two films with, you know, my first two films when I was 17. And he said, Aaron Copland is here, because Aaron Copland had done the music for the North Star. And he came on the set one day and was standing by me, and he said, you're a very good young man. And I said, thank you. And he said, I guess, who are you? And he laughed, and he said, well, I'm working on some songs and things for the movie. And so later I realized, you know, I knew who he was, and he sent me an album of his. I saw him, I heard he was leaving, and I went to say goodbye to him. And that was it. And then, you know, I was in the Navy and blah, 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 blah. And then I came out, and I found that Milestone was working on the Red Pony. And I went out to see him. And he said, Aaron is doing the music for this movie. You should see him, too. And I said, oh, I'd love to. And I made a date to meet him at a little restaurant. And he met me, and we had a wonderful time. And I was being very grand about what I knew about music and, you know, all the composers that I played and loved and blah, blah, blah. And he just really laughed and giggled at me, you know, and he was just marvelous. And like a day or two later, I got called into the office and told, yeah, I should not be seen with Aaron Copland. And I said, how dare you? I said, this is a magnificent, important man and a most talented man. And you know, I was just furious with them. And I walked out. You know, I just walked out. I said, if you're going to tell me that I'm not allowed to see Aaron Copland, then you just, you know, forget it. I stormed out. I was very, really very angry.
Well, that's not something you hear a lot about when it comes to the studio system. Usually a lot of people toe the company line.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
So you, from that regard, you were certainly far more independent than a lot of actors and actresses that were your contemporaries.
Right. Yeah, I was. I had to be me, you know, whatever.
Being that independent, did it ever affect the potential roles that you got? In other words, were things passed to others because the studio would felt that, no, not Farley?
No, I stood on my feet pretty strongly. You know, I just said, you know, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And the problem was that Goldwyn, I mean, I played so many parts at Goldwyn's where I was practically playing the same part, you know, that I'd done in the movie before. And they were not at all imaginative with me as far as I was concerned. And I was very annoyed at that, and I was put on suspension a lot because I would refuse to do some piece of junk that they wanted me to be loaned out to.
Farley, you've worked at films, television, Broadway. Do you have a preferred medium?
Yeah, yes, I do. The theater.
And why is that?
Because it's more enjoyable. You feel like you've done something more than movies. You know, movies, you usually shoot at the beginning, you shoot whatever it is that has the most people in it. You know, it could be the middle of the movie or the finale. And then you go back and you just shoot all cockeyed and everything. And you get used to that, but it's not good. And to start at the beginning and go to a middle and go to an end is heaven. I came to New York in like 1949, I think it was, for the first time. And I had met friends, Betty Comden and Adolph Green and Leonard Bernstein and all these people out in Hollywood. And they were back here now in New York, and so I knew people here. And the first show I saw was Annie Get Your Gun with Ethel Merman, and it just did me in. You know, I absolutely said, that's where you're a star. That's where you're really something, is on that stage.
Now, you mentioned there was a little bit of apprehension of anticipation of, you know, somebody coming from Hollywood to be on Broadway. Had you done any stage work before going to Broadway?
No.
And that wasn't intimidating to you in any way, shape, or form?
No. Well, I tell you what worked for me. I came here, and there was a great deal of live television going on here.
Right.
And I luckily fell into that, and I did a lot of shows and very good shows for television, you know, live. You know, I learned a lot from that because I got young Freud the night before I was supposed to go to rehearsal, and he was in practically every scene and everything. And I went to the rehearsal, and the director was greeting me, and he's a very nice man and everything. And we started to read the thing off the script, and he said, "I don't want that script in your hand." And I said, "But I don't know any of this. I mean, I got this script last night." And he said, "I don't care. I want it out of your hands." And I said, "Okay." So that's how it began with me. And I loved working on live television. I really did. I had great fun.
Now, that was at a time, too, since you came from Hollywood, when a lot of Hollywood stars people were trying to talk them out of doing this newfangled medium of television. Anybody try to talk you out of it?
No, because, you know, I was away from Hollywood, and I was... life with Goldwyn was over. You know.
You also ended up for a short period of time working on, as I alluded to earlier, my favorite daytime television show, and that is As the World Turns.
Yeah.
What was it like for you having a regular character on a show like that where it's just pages of dialogue every day? And I've always maintained that there's probably nothing harder for actors than doing a daytime soap.
Yeah, I think it's difficult, but you can fall into the habit of doing it, which I didn't really, because I just wanted the stage, you know, and I did it, and I did it as well as I could, but I was much better on the stage.
He hated it.
I what?
I said you hated it.
Yeah, I hated it.
He hated every minute of it.
I hated it.
He finally developed something that he had not been plagued with since the days he was under contract to Goldwyn, which was spastic colitis. And it was just from the stress of not liking what you were doing every day.
Yeah.
And... fortunately, we had a terrific writer at that time. Those were good years on World Turn, but the others liked it better. and it was very hard for us being partners, and it was hard on me as much as it was on him, because I hated seeing the pain he was in.
Back in the day when you first came to Broadway after leaving Hollywood and leaving the studio system, of course, films, people go to the movies and you become an instant celebrity after being in a film, especially if it's successful. When you first go to Broadway, do people give you the chance, and I'm talking about both the producers and directors and also the audience, do they come to see Farley Granger, the great actor, in a role, or do they want to see the guy from A Stranger on a Train?
Well, then they came to see the the guy on the stranger on the train.
Does that bother you in any way, shape, or form, or is it?
No, it didn't bother me at all. I expected that if they hadn't seen me in anything else, that's what they had seen me in, and that's why they came to see me in the play, whatever. And one of my great joys was in the Crucible, Arthur Miller. And one matinee, and we were in New York then, Bob came back to my dressing room and said, "Arthur Miller's here, Arthur Miller's here, and he wants to see you." I said, "Oh, my God." I said, okay. And Arthur Miller came in, and he said, "This is what I meant it to be. This is what it should have been when it was first done." And went on and on with such praise, I couldn't believe it. And he asked to see everybody in the company and went down and shook everybody's hand. Now, see, that you don't get in the movies, kiddo.
That was a portion of the interview I did back in May of 2007 with actor Farley Granger and his life partner, Robert Calhoun. Farley passed away on March 27th at the age of 85. And by the way, Robert Calhoun passed away in May of 2008 at the age of 77. The book they wrote together was Farley's memoirs, entitled Include Me Out. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0085, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test later.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the author of Useful Information for Everyday Living. Plus, we have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. And, of course, there's an idiot of the day. And lots more Stuff File news, including right here, right now. As you know, we often say on this show that everything happens at Walmart. Now, police in Elyria, Ohio, arrested 49-year-old Toni Duncan after she actually did what many have thought of doing. Duncan was leaving a Walmart store when the 71-year-old greeter asked to see her receipt. She snapped. She responded by pushing a cart into the greeter, grabbing his throat, and choking him. She was arrested and charged with assault, and because the apple never falls far from the tree, her 21-year-old pregnant daughter, Ashley Jackson, who was with her at the time, was also arrested after she allegedly threatened to blow up the store and that the greeter would be dead when her boyfriend learned of the incident. Ah, yes. Good times. And still with Walmart, in Ocala, Florida, an Ocala, Florida man's girlfriend was about to be released from jail and he wanted to get her a special gift, two bras, one red, the other a zebra print. The local Walmart, however, says he stuffed them into his pants and didn't pay for them. I messed up and I ain't sorry about it, said Johnny Brown, age 25, after his recent arrest on retail petty theft. Why did he do it? Here's a quote. She has done so much for me. I felt I had to support her. Yeah. You have to wonder about a guy who says he'll support his gal, but only means with underwires. Meanwhile, Byron Preston, age 15, hasn't gone to school for 4 months. Instead, he works at his father's barbershop in Laurel, Maryland. He'd rather be in school, but he was expelled for possession of a weapon, a tattoo gun, which he took to school to practice tattooing on fruit. It doesn't shoot anything, complains his father, James. It just happens to have the word gun. But school officials won't listen, saying, a student having a gun at school calls for automatic expulsion according to their zero-tolerance policy. A Prince George County public school spokesperson says, the policy is under review by the school board. The Prestons have been told verbally that they won the appeal for the expulsion, but somehow the paperwork to reinstate Byron in school has never shown up. Wow. You know, if school officials won't do their jobs like professionals, maybe we can make their paychecks never show up. How about that? And by the way, I wonder if there are any glue guns at the school. Just asking. Apparently they have a problem with anything with the word gun in it. I don't know. I just love these zero-tolerance stories. Not. I've got another one, by the way. When John Haynes, an eighth-grade math teacher at Selby Lane School in Atherton, California, couldn't get students to pay attention, he lifted a desk a few inches off the floor and dropped it. That got the students' attention, including one girl who ran out of the room and called 911 because the noise scared her. Oh, poor little baby. Yeah, when police arrived, all was calm in the classroom and students were paying attention. It wasn't a teacher out of control, said Police Sergeant Tim Lynch, adding, Haynes hadn't thrown anything. He just picked up a desk and dropped it. I've actually seen teachers do that in the past, too. Anyway. Still, the school official suspended Haynes from teaching, even though it was the first time anyone ever made a complaint against the, quote, excellent teacher, unquote, because of the nature of the complaint. So, hey, teachers, do you still support zero tolerance now? Just asking. Moving right along, investigators at an arson scene in Titusville, Florida, found a clue as to who the arsonist might be, a latex glove with a fingertip inside. The criminal had apparently gotten his finger caught in a door on his way out and left it behind when he fled. Officers stopped at a local hospital and sure enough found Ishmael Ortiz, age 24, being treated for a missing fingertip. He quickly confessed, and police now want to find the man who hired him for the insurance scam. Investigators are now asking that anyone with information please call their tip line. Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our next guest, two women in Chattanooga, Tennessee, had their sights set on the same man and apparently were willing to go to war over him. The shot across the bow occurred when one of the women, Leela Cross, age 20, spat ice cream at the other's car. And wouldn't you like to see that scene? Some woman frothing at the mouth, spitting ice cream at some other woman's vehicle. Classy. Classy indeed. She said this was in retaliation for Consuelo McRoby having thrown eggs at her house. I should have thought twice about that situation, McRoby, who was 19, said. I should have been at church, actually. The feud escalated again when Cross drove by McRoby's house and allegedly opened fire on Cross's car. That brought the police, who had to sort out what had happened. You know, the cops investigated the shooting the same way as the egg-throwing incident. They did it by collecting shell casings. There you go. I know it's a bad pun, but let's just move on, shall we? Let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program, as a matter of fact. Do your children have the tools they need to make it on their own in the world? Well, Michelle Sfikianos is the author of Useful Information for Everyday Living. She has some of the answers that might help you, and she's on the line with us right now from Florida. Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
Thanks for being on the program with us. You've written this book because it's interesting. I remember when I was going to school, and I went to school back in the 60s, they seemed to have more classes, or at least a portion of the day, where they taught some things that were useful information and tips for living besides the three R's. They don't seem to do that anymore, do they?
No, they don't. I did a lot of research and found where our home economics courses and a lot of the like basic math, finance courses where they teach you how to balance a checkbook have been removed from most school curriculums.
At what point did you feel you needed to write this book? Obviously, you'd seen situations where it was needed and it was useful. Was there any moment where push came to shove for you?
Yes, I have two grown children, and one of which was getting ready to leave the home. And, you know, just kind of did a reassessment of myself, wanting to know had I done everything I needed to do to prepare her to move out on her own, to take care of a home, to take care of her finances, you know, to take care of everything that she needed to do, those basic life skills, you know.
And did you, and was she?
To a point. Like most parents, you know, you get into the habit of doing everything for your kids. Because, you know, this is a fast-paced world that we live in, and technology is just booming. And so you get to a point to where I believe you just, you know, you run through the house, you pick everything up, you clean everything up, and you don't think, you know, maybe I should be involving the children or the younger children, you know, giving them chores and creating that sense of, you know, accomplishment within them so that they can later on go out and do their own thing.
Okay, well, let's back up a little bit. How prepared were you to leave the house?
I wasn't. Learned everything the hard way.
And is there
no,
something...
I can't say that. I'm kidding. My mother did, you know, she taught me how to do laundry when I was a teenager. She taught me to cook basic things, you know, when I was a teenager. But there's also that, you know, I had a home economics class when I was in junior high. So, you know, I kind of felt like I had a little bit of a baseline. But then, you know, when you move out on your own and reality hits you, maybe it wasn't enough of a baseline.
Okay, well, two schools of thought there. You're going your route, saying that give them as much information as possible, and hopefully it'll make that fall more gentle when they hit the real world. Or there are lessons they have to learn, and some of them have to be done the hard way.
Well, and you know, everybody attends the school of hard knocks. However, I really think, you know, it's not just enough to learn the basics, to teach them the basics. I think you have to have that follow through. You have to have that repetitive behavior, you know, in order for them to really grab that concept to experience those responsible life skills.
Okay, so let's put this into practice. How do you encourage, for instance, your teen or 20-something to get off the couch and learn to live independently?
Well, I think you have to have chores. You give them responsibilities within the house. It reinforce those. It, you know, if it's not done right the first time, it's not to say everybody has to have a white glove home. But, you know, I do believe you have to have a clean home because you have to focus on the safety aspect of that clean home as well. You know, I think you need to get them involved in looking at expiration dates on products that they're eating or, you know, use-by dates. There's two different dates there. I think it's just those little things that if they're not taught, you know, later on could, you know, lead to a sickness, an illness, you know, even something, you know, more important, that you know, like cleaning, mixing cleaning products. You don't want certain products, they really can't be mixed because they could be fatal. They could be poisonous. They could, you know, let off poisonous gases. And, you know, you really don't want to find your teenager lying on the floor.
Now, how early should some of these lessons be taught?
Well, I really believe you can start as young, you know, as young as you possibly can. I know a lot of kids 5, 6 years old want to, you know, pick up around the house, want to be responsible for an area of the house, because it gives them a sense of part of the family, you know. And then when you get into your teenage years, I really believe that's the tough stuff, you know, the dishes, the laundry. You know, you can teach them the basics of cooking, but start with the basics, you know. Turn those pot handles towards the wall so they're not out where, you know, a child or some, even your loose clothes could get wrapped up in them and pull the hot fluid on you.
Now, you talk about the age differences, and one of the things I found is that, and I think most people find this as well, at an earlier age, kids really, really want to help, and that's a good time to at least teach them some of the simple, basic situations, as opposed to when they're teenagers, when they usually don't want anything to do with you.
You're right. However, you know, everything in life has consequences. Some are good, some are bad, and I think, you know, if you give them certain chores to do, then there should be a reward system or, you know, good consequences because of those chores that they did. And I think that gives them something to work for, something to look forward to, because, you know, when you get out on your own, a clean house is not just a clean house. You know, that first impression of somebody coming over to your house, it can make or break you.
Now, let me throw the gender card in here very quickly, because, you know, a clean house is a clean house, but what a guy considers a clean house and what a woman considers a clean house might be two different things.
And the other role could be reversed as well. Just because you're a woman does not necessarily mean your house is clean. I've seen, you know, I've been to several college kids' houses to where some of the male houses were, you know, much more picked up and cleaner in appearance than some of the females.
I
don't think it's gender specific. I think it's all in, you know, what makes you proud of yourself and how can that make you proud of your environment and who did you learn that from?
Okay, well, let's throw in some stereotypes for a second. It's been my experience that a woman who is sloppy might have things all over the place. A guy who thinks he's neat might have everything in place but an inch of dust on it.
Right. And that's what I said. You know, you don't have to have a white glove home, but you do have to have those basics. You know, you may have a inch of dust on your furniture, but that air conditioning filter that hasn't been changed in 6 months, I mean, that should be changed monthly, that has dust and dust mites in it, which is one of your major contributors to allergic reactions, making you sick. The dust on your furniture, it may not be making you sick, but that dust in your air conditioning filter will.
Is your book designed for someone to teach their offspring how to be more independent, or is your book designed for the parent to just simply give to the offspring and say, here, there you go?
I actually believe it could be both. You know, it's very easy to understand. It's all bullet pointed. It is quick. You know, a lot of our young adults, if it's not quick, it's not learned, you know. But I feel that it's not only would be a tool that the parents could use to teach, it could also be a reference guide or mom's advice always on hand for your young adults. And it could also serve as a tool for those, say, getting out of a 20-plus year marriage where your spouse probably did most of the housework.
Another group entirely that has to deal
with this. Absolutely.
Yeah. A very interesting book indeed. I thank you very, very much, Michelle, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you.
Michelle Sfakianos, the author of Useful Information for Everyday Living. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0085, and you will find links to Michelle's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It's a little-known fact that there's a new lawsuit filed every 2 seconds in the United States. Imagine that. Over the next minute, 30 new lawsuits will be filed. It comes as no surprise to most people that we're the most lawsuit-happy nation on Earth, but it's a mystery to many how the lawsuit problem got so bad. Now, a new book helps explain how we got to this point. The book is entitled Schools for Misrule, and it reveals that after World War II, law schools actually started to teach their students differently. Law schools began to encourage the use of lawsuits as a way to change policy, something that had mostly been left to elected public officials up until then. Now, let's be fair, there are many other reasons for all of the lawsuits today. The U.S. lets lawyers charge contingency fees, and that makes it easier to sue. America's lack of a loser pays system is another reason. But if we really want to know where the lawsuit explosion started, author Walter Olson says we need to look at the law schools. Learn more. Visit my website at bobdorigojones.com.
If you're into the paranormal, then you're into Don Ecker and Dark Matters.
Something I have been immersed in for 20 years. Lunar research on items known as lunar transient phenomena. For over 400 years, world-class astronomers have been observing strange sights, lights, flashes, and other things on the moon.
Provocative topics, listeners' calls, and interesting guests.
My guest, Mr. Alan Stern.
On my website, I have a list of 100 or so lunar conspiracy theories. I had to kind of come to terms with one of them that I hadn't really thought about.
It's the kind of show that might keep you up at night.
Speculation is, at some time in our past, or perhaps even today, there is another presence on the moon. And I'm not talking about indigenous lunar folks. I'm talking about a space base by somebody else on the far side.
Dark Matters with Don Ecker, exclusively on CyberStationUSA.com.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, we do indeed have Stuart Nallman with another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hello, Peter. Are you going to buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack? I don't care if I ever get back.
You know, it's root, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, that's right. It's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out.
Yeah.
The old ball game is back again.
Baseball. I remember what that was. Yeah, when we had a team here in Montreal. But let's digress.
I know, but let's talk about baseball. On this edition of Book Banter, we got a book called The Last Boy, and you'll find out who he is shortly. Because it's Mickey Mantle.
Okay.
Probably one of the greatest players ever to wear the pinstripes of the New York Yankees. In fact, he symbolized the Yankees of the 50s and 60s when they won 12 American League pennants, 7 World Series championships as well. And his powerful swing and ability to hit impossible home runs made him the idol of millions of fans, especially young fans who aspired to be like the Mick. But behind the pinstripes, the championships, and the home runs was a ballplayer as a tragic figure. Plagued with injuries, especially his fragile knees and joints, beset with domestic problems and weakened by endless carousing and alcoholism, Mickey Mantle's life on and off the diamond could have easily been a Shakespearean tragedy. In fact, former Yankee teammate Tom Tresh usually summed up the true nature of Mickey Mantle when he said, "Just think how great he'd have been if he had confidence, knees, and confidence." So author Jane Levy, she wrote an excellent book about Sandy Koufax. She takes a look behind the pinstripe, one of the most probing biographies of this Yankee Hall of Famer, in her latest book called The Last Boy. And her main argument is that Mantle carved out a legendary career in baseball by being a man-child. Called him the last boy in the last decade ruled by boys. That was the 1950s. And even when he became a superstar with the Yankees and after his retirement in 1969, he just never learned how to become a mature adult. The Last Boy is not just another chronological biography of a legendary baseball player. Each chapter puts Mantle's life and career in the context of certain events that shaped him. There would be his knee injury during Game 2 of the 1951 World Series that forever changed his life. His Triple Crown season of 1956, which launched the Mantle legacy and the Mantle legend. His New York restaurant when it opened in 1988, and how he single-handedly launched the baseball card and memorabilia boom. Today, 1994, when he entered rehab, admitted that he was an alcoholic, a problem that spread practically throughout his entire family, including his wife and kids. The Last Boy, I found, was quite a powerful book of a Hall of Fame player and All-American role model, and his very sad, flawed human had a strong sense of confidence and a strong set of knees. He would have been an individual, an adult, with a much stronger character.
Wow. Very interesting character, and there are so many baseball books out there, so I'm getting baseball books you could recommend if people want to go down that route besides reading the Mickey Mantle book.
Well, yeah, I focus this time on books about the Yankees. We have to start with, of course, Ball 4 by Jim Boughton, which is probably one of the first tell-all books about the life of Major League Baseball. In fact, you know, Mantle was not thrilled about this book, and towards the end of his life, he actually forgave Boughton for, you know, about all the controversy that Ball 4 caused. So that's one that you should read. Another one is Robert Creamer, who is an excellent writer, who wrote a book, he wrote the first definitive biography of Babe Ruth, but the one I recommend is his biography of Casey Stengel called Casey, His Life and Times. And if you really get to know about, this peculiar manager who was a very successful manager, but also his years as a player with the Giants and the Dodgers as well. And another book that if you could find, it's quite a treasure. It's called the DiMaggio Albums. It's a beautifully slipcased double volume hardcover, which is basically a scrapbook of Joe DiMaggio's life and career seen through memorabilia, news clippings, magazine articles. And this book was actually done with the permission and authority of Joe DiMaggio himself. And a beautiful book, actually. I have a copy of it. It's really it's the closest thing we'll get to a DiMaggio autobiography, actually.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot with a trivia question that I do not know the answer to, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I'm wondering, in your estimation, is there any team more written about in sports?
Quite a few about the Red Sox as well, and there are some about the Montreal Canadiens as well. But I think they don't hold a candle to what's written about the Bronx Bombers. So I think if it's a close second, it'd probably be the Dodgers, both Los Angeles and Brooklyn.
If all these books were still in print, you could probably fill a section of a bookstore with just Yankee books.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, maybe someone should do a sports bookstore. You know, that'd be a great specialized store. I'll tell you that. And there'll be a special, maybe a Yankees room. You may never know. I think that'd be a great idea.
Okay, so the book is called The Last Boy?
The Last Boy by Jane Levy. It's published by Harper, and it's $32.99. And also, you get a reader biography of Sandy Koufax as well, which is available in paperback, too.
Okay. And how can people get in contact with you and find you?
Well, if you can't read me on paper, you can read me online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome, Peter. Now I got to go back to the bullpen. Got some warm-ups to do.
Okay, Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost at the end of this edition of the Stuff File program, and we will get to the idiot of the day. But before we get to that, a couple more Stuff File news stories that I want to get to. In Italy, Giancarlo Sabatini managed to evade police for an entire decade after he went into hiding in 2000 after receiving a 4-year prison sentence for cocaine trafficking. But it was his wife's delicious lasagna which ultimately did him in. Acting on a tip, police staked out the homes of Sabatini's wife and daughter in a small town near Rome. When they saw the daughter leaving her mother's house and nervously dashing toward her home holding a tray of lasagna, police suspected perhaps that she had a special guest. So they burst in and found and arrested Sabatini. Now, many Italians prepare lasagna with meat sauce for lunch on the Tuesday before Ash Wednesday. Apparently, our boy came from his hiding, or at least his hideout, rather, in Belgium to celebrate the last day of Carnival before Lent with his family. So now he has given up his freedom for the next 40 days and then some. Wow, that must be some really, really good lasagna. Is it worth going to jail for, pal? Wow, really good lasagna. Police in Pennsylvania said a suspected car thief spent about 2.5 hours hiding in the ceiling of a building before they caught a whiff of his cigarette smoke. South Greensburg Police Chief Scott Fanchalski said he went to a BP gas station on a report of a man who had no money to pay for his gasoline, and the suspect fled when Fanchalski ran the vehicle's registration and discovered it was reported stolen. The suspect, who lost his shirt during a brief struggle with Fanchalski, fled to a nearby Wellington Square professional building where authorities soon instituted a lockdown. Fanchalski said the building was on lockdown for about 2.5 hours before pieces of broken ceiling tile were noticed on a fourth-story bathroom floor, and the telltale odor of cigarette smoke was noticed coming from the ceiling crawl space. Fanchalski said he crawled into the ceiling and found the suspect, who agreed to surrender. I bet that guy is really sorry he didn't give up smoking earlier. It's an evil, ugly, disgusting habit, and it can kill you, or in this case, just simply incarcerate you. Okay, a man allegedly stole a 30-pack of beer from a convenience store in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the cop who responded was nice enough to tell him, just go back and pay for the beer. But Christopher Springwater Knott, age 25, wasn't taking any favors. He got into his car and left. The ensuing chase, and I'm doing air quotes here, chase, was anything but high speed. Icy roads prevented any kind of fast getaway, but the suspect still managed to crash into a parked truck. Knott took off on foot, leaving his female companion behind. Classy. Both were captured. The suspects bragged that had it not been for the icy road conditions, they would have easily outrun the pursuing patrol car. Knott was charged with driving under the influence, 6 counts of failure to stop at a stop sign, and driving too fast for the conditions. His passenger, Trina Renee Brown, age 32, was charged with public intoxication. You know, he brags about his driving, but the cop didn't crash. Oh, no. Only he did. I'm just saying. Just saying. Okay. Kevin Cheeks, age 44, has been convicted of 3 counts of robbery in Queens, New York. His getaway vehicle was easy for witnesses to describe. It was an ambulance. Cheeks had been an ambulance driver for 2 months and had checked the rig out, not knowing it had a GPS tracking device installed. A tracking record showed he parked at the scene of the robbery, then sped away afterwards. When he returned the ambulance, police were waiting for him. As a persistent, violent felon, Cheeks faces up to 20 years in prison for the crime. Wait a minute. New York allows persistent, violent felons to work on ambulances? Wow. You know, I'm all for letting bygones be bygones and literally turning the other cheek, in this case, Kevin Cheeks. But persistent, violent felons? Is this really someone you want driving an ambulance? I mean, the word persistent tells me violence is not something he plans to stop doing. How does he get hired? I don't know. Kind of idiotic. Which leads us to the final story of the program, and of course that would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the idiot of the day.
When moving a large item, it is best not to involve an idiot, because if you do, that can only lead to guilt by association. Timothy Walker, age 48, was hospitalized in Burlington, North Carolina in February after he fell off of an SUV while he was on top. No, he wasn't up there for kicks. No, he wasn't car surfing. No, he wasn't doing any of those things. He was actually, at least he thought, providing a valuable service, and by extension, so did the driver. 48-year-old Timmy was holding down 2 mattresses for the driver, who apparently rounded a corner too fast. Why would someone ride atop an SUV to hold down mattresses? Well, in this case, there are 2 reasons. One, a complete and utter lack of understanding of basic high school physics. And 2, he's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0085. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you can find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. And again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0085. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can find a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Getting Jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.
Mm-hmm.